Beryl Lorry, Reel 7. Yes, you were saying earlier that you had interesting leisure time. Is that right?
Well, there was a lighter side to Nuremberg, almost inevitably, seeing that we were being administered by the Americans. Not only had they taken over accommodation and the hotel in Nuremberg, but they'd taken over virtually the whole of the Garmisch ski resort. And they had free time officer, a girl called Sarah Kruskal, Kruskall, who was a very pleasant, very able person. And all one really needed to do was to pop into her office on a Monday morning and say you would like a weekend in Bavaria. And, you know, their tickets were available to you. And you went down to Garmisch, Partenkirchen, which is beautiful beyond imagining. It's way up in the Bavarian Alps, the higher mountains, snow-covered all the year round. And there were various hotels on the various lakes, which offered things like water skiing or forest rambling or a whole variety of interests. But right at the very, very top, on the highest peak, there was the Zugspitze, the highest mountain in Garmisch, where there was nothing but snow. And one fateful weekend, I found myself unwillingly, as a non-skier, landed up among the snowdrifts on this mountain. And there was nothing to do if you didn't ski. You just sat inside and watched the snow falling down outside. So I thought, fine, I'll get a book and I'll sit inside and watch the snow. And I came down from my room and walked into a large hall running the length of the hotel. And at the far end, there was a dramatic figure. It was, I can only describe it as a Michelin man, but instead of being tires, it was bandages. From head to toe, arms, hands, feet, legs, round the middle and everything. And I stopped in my tracks and a sepulchral voice emerged from this mass of bandages and said, "Don't worry, only the experts do this." And I walked up to him and it transpired that he'd piled up the previous day. And he said, "You know, you really ought to have a go. There are all the instructors out there. You'll never get a better chance." So off went Mugme, and it was quite extraordinary. We paid $1 per day for full board in the hotel, which included hire of skis and an alpine instructor. And I learnt to ski and absolutely loved it. And there was another occasion when I made a trip on during a leave period down to Italy, given a lift by one of the other lawyers on the War Crimes Commission. And so, you know, there really were lots of things that we managed to do and see. I got right down as far as Capri and visited Austria and so on and so forth. We were extravagantly well looked after. And I, throughout my time there, throughout 2 years there, and entirely acceptably, and it was entirely legal, I was sending stuff home to my family, things like wristwatches and nylon stockings and perfume and things like this, which we could get without any problem. I bought a superb Leica camera during my time in Germany, which I still have, and my grandchildren think it's marvellous. They say it's the Rolls Royce, you know, the vintage Rolls Royce in the family. So, yes, the leisure time was very well catered for.
You must have missed all that after this when this job finished.
I don't think, having just talked my head off for 3 hours, I don't think I'm a committed looker back. I tend very much to enjoy the next stage ahead. And when I came back, there was quite a demand for German.
This would have been 1949,
early 49. And I applied for a job in the BBC in the German monitoring service at Caversham, just outside Reading. This was the service, the BBC service, which accumulated low-grade intelligence, both for purposes of its own programming and also, I imagine, for what value it might be to the government. The German team at this particular stage was a big team, and there were those who worked on newspapers and other publications, and there were those who worked on voice monitoring. And it happened that I was the only person doing the voice monitoring. All the rest of the team were in fact refugees from Central Europe. A very interesting and very agreeable crowd of people. What happened was that, yeah, it sounds terribly old-fashioned, but we recorded onto black wax cylinders, which were placed horizontally along an arm from the recording machine with a needle poised over them. And as you switched on, the spindle on which the cylinder sat began to rotate, and the needle recorded deeper or shallower according to the voice, you know, and the words came through because of the actual depth of the recording on wax.
And who were these voices? Where did they...
We picked up radio stations from all over Europe, from Russia, from anywhere that was broadcasting in German, anywhere at all. And it was quite a lot of it was economic information, you know, the progress of the re-established dairy farming industry, the establishment of consumer goods factories. It was low-grade, economic, and any other bits of intelligence that we could pick up. And I lived in a tiny village beside the River Thames, about 4 miles away from Caversham, and I very much enjoyed it. But there came a time when I was invited by the British Council to apply for a job. And I went to my senior in the monitoring service and I said, this is my position, can you give me some idea of what future I have here? And he said, I'll be brutally honest with you, because this is one of the very, very few professional jobs available to refugees in this country, you will not be allowed to climb the ladder. Go for the British Council, and if you get it, good luck to you. And if you don't, clearly your job is here. And so I went ahead and put in an application to the British Council. And I was appointed as a lecturer to Prague. And I went out to Prague in the summer of 1949.
Was that a lecturer in languages?
In English. The British Council? Would you like it? The British Council started very briefly in 1935 at a time when Anthony Eden realised that the era of gunboat diplomacy was over and that if Britain wanted to continue to exert an influence in the world, the way to do it was on the basis of knowledge and understanding. And so the British Council was formed. In a way, it can be paralleled with the Institut Français or with the Goethe Institute, but it was different in many ways. It works at this stage in very nearly 100 countries in the world, where its responsibilities include fostering constructive interests and so on in the receiving country. In my time, it brought scholars from all over the world into Britain. It brought more senior people on visitorships to work alongside their opposite numbers in this country in such a way that when they went back to pursue their own particular careers, their contacts were in Britain and there was a personal understanding. The council took out visiting VIPs to lecture with people like anaesthetists or a very wide range. I mean, a sports specialist, scientists, agriculturalists, and so on. And the whole idea in those days was to make Britain and the best of things British, known, available, understood overseas. It also ran libraries of literature and reference books in the English language in all these countries, served many of the overseas universities that didn't have their libraries. And we always felt, Todd was in the British Council, of course, we felt that we were particularly privileged to earn our living by working in an organisation which we believed was constructive and has done a lot to establish friendships and the element of trust and so on and so forth. Very varied in its work. The icing on its cake was the kind of things like the Royal Ballet going out on world tours or a JMW Turner exhibition, this kind of thing.
What were you doing in Prague? You know, how did that...
A basic assignment of all British Council offices overseas was the teaching of English, but not to school children, teaching at the level of teachers of English, whereby they cunningly, for a minimal investment, you spread the skills out. If you were working with teachers of English, they were going out into their schools and colleges and so on. We had a huge library. The council was invited back into Czechoslovakia. The Russians, of course, came. They were the Allied power that liberated Czechoslovakia, to the intense dismay of the Czechs. Many, many, many of whose citizens had served in the Free Czech forces in this country. And they were horror-stricken that it was not Britain coming in. They were also horror-stricken, I think possibly, because they knew a thing or two about Russian methods. And Benesch was the president at that time, and he invited the British Council in very generous circumstances. He gave the council for its use a palace, what's the word I'm looking for? And it's an architectural term. The one that is gold tinted anyway, it doesn't matter, in which to establish our operation. And we had a big library, we had an officer in charge of music, we had a big English teaching team under the leadership of somebody called Leonard Tibbett. T-I-B-B-E-T, maybe double T, who was a big name in the teaching of English as a foreign language. He succeeded a man called W. Stannard Allen, who is well known for his textbooks still widely in use. And alongside the teaching, the English teaching priority, we ran a series of lectures which were phenomenally well attended, bringing in VIP lecturers from this country, and we were the only outlet onto the West for a population which was now, by the time I got there, firmly under the heel of a very rigid Russian-dictated communist government. And so whatever we did, we were oversubscribed by masses, absolutely masses. Our lectures were full to the gills kind of thing. We had on the staff a number of interesting people. Our representative, as he was called at that time, he would now be a British Council director, was Reg Close, who became a very good friend of ours. In fact, he proposed the health of the bride at our wedding. He was a lovely person, both he and his wife. He had experience of China, and we always felt that he had this kind of amazingly sinuous way of coping with problems, which left everybody with their face intact. But he had won his way through to where he wanted to go. He was very skilled, and he did a terrific job in Prague. There was another girl on the English teaching team called Mary Bosday, and I actually travelled out with a lass called Eve Byrne, who was in fact sent home in a certain degree of disgrace because she was one of the few council appointments who really proved that the council was not her line. There was a good friend of mine with whom I shared an office, a girl called Marjorie Whittaker, an older couple. With all of these, I'm still in touch. Actually, Reg Close died recently. But and a team of quite amazingly loyal Czech local staff. They were wonderful because the job that they were doing in the ethos of communism that prevailed was dangerous. There was no doubt they were suspect. There was an excellent driver who was a man who did everything, knew everyone, achieved everything, managed everything. You know, he was a terrific thing. He was, his name was Krotz, K-R-O-T, with a little heart check over it. When I arrived there, I was put into the Palace Hotel, which was just diagonally opposite from the palace in which the council pursued its activities. And there, it very quickly transpired that I was going to have difficulty in getting gigs because communists didn't want a Westerner and the non-communists didn't take a Westerner. And so I spent actually 3 months in that hotel, and during the course of that time, the Czechs appeared to become very restless about the impact that we were having. Their propaganda, and again, they had all sources of information in their control, and their propaganda was putting out that Britain was in a state of post-war paralysis, the children all had rickets, epidemic disease was rife, food supplies were totally inadequate, and Britain was on its knees. Meanwhile, we were bringing in professional journals like, you know, the BMJ and Nature and engineering journals and so on, which were accurately reporting the state of Britain and of their particular professions. And this did not meet with the requirements of the communists. The communists in general don't like that which they can't control. And in these ways, they couldn't control us. The council is strictly not non-political. It is not the government department. And therefore, we had freedom in a great measure. It's comparable, kind of, to the BBC. With its own charter in that respect. Anyway, in the hotel was I. And during those first 3 months, a situation arose in which all the single young women on the staff, and I suppose there were about six of us, expatriates, found ourselves with a little personal sleuth. And my little sleuth, It was so obvious it wasn't true, and I half suspect that they wanted it to be obvious. I think it was probably a scare tactic. He used to wear his brown trilby and his leather jacket and suede correspondent shoes and carry his little briefcase, and he was always there behind me. And I used to go into the hotel at the end of a day's work, and he would follow me up the stairs, and I would go into my bedroom and turn the key in the door. One very quickly learnt to be careful, and you kept your papers with you. You didn't leave them in locked drawers or anything like this. Anyway, this situation flourished, and it was so blatant that it didn't really hurt. Just now and again, there was a problem. Marjorie Whittaker, the girl with whom I shared an office, lived out in a suburb called Hradčany, H-R-A-D-O, C with a heart check over it, A-N-Y, which meant a tram journey from work. And one evening, she had been the last in the building, there had been a lecturer, and she was locking up and so on, and she got off the tram at her stop. And in order to get to her home, she had to go walk a little distance. And as she was walking in the darkness, she heard a very steady footfall behind her. And she stopped and fastened her shoes, and the footsteps stopped. And she walked on, followed, and she stopped and lit a cigarette. And she heard a cigarette lighter behind her flick. And between her and her digs, there was a little snicket, you know, a tiny, narrow little passageway, unlit. and she wasn't really very keen to walk into this late at night. However, she did, but as she walked, it occurred to her that her left arm was full of a heavy pile of books, and the opening system of her door was the typical European system, whereby you press a button on the outer gate, and the concierge presses a responding button inside, and she realised that in the moment when she was pushing, both her arms would be pulled out of action. And she did, and hands went round her neck. And she did the one sensible thing that she could do. She screamed at the top of her voice. She was, I may say, a totally unflappable girl. But it was a very wise, spontaneous reaction. And the man ran away. But it was getting to that kind of little point, you know. Clearly they didn't like us being there anymore. And in the hotel one evening, I had dinner. And it got to be a real game. I would sit on this side, my side of a table, because I'd seen my sleuth sitting on the opposite side of the table there. And I would make jolly sure I would choose something that was going to take a long time to prepare. And the poor little man would sit endlessly spinning out his meal, you know. And on this particular evening, I went back up to my bedroom and locked the door, and I decided I would take a bath. And I picked up my nightdress, put on my dressing gown, picked up a sponge bag, opened the door, went out, down to the bathroom to run the bath. And I suddenly realised that I left my handbag with my passport in it on the bed. And so I belted back down the corridor, and the door was open, and Brother Sleuth was in my room with my handbag open and my passport in my hand. And very obviously started to play drunk at me. And I just took him by the shoulders and shoved him out through the door. So it was, you know, all along it was hotting up a little bit and a little bit. And about that time, our librarian, who was one Frank Turner, came upstairs to me from the library and he said, I've got a lady downstairs who has come in and asked for a fair-haired, short, English woman who's looking for digs. So I swallowed twice and said, fine, I'll come down. And it transpired that this really very charming Czech woman, a widow, had had two sons. Her husband had died tragically of a viral infection when her children were tiny, and she had brought these two boys up. During the war, the elder of the two was seized by the Germans in his teenage years and sent down the mines. The younger son had survived the war because he was younger than they were taking. And very recently, before my arrival in Prague, he had died in a similar way to his father, very suddenly, in a matter of days. And she realized that unless she filled his room, she would have a worker family billeted on her. She herself spoke fluent English and was very pro-British. Her son, meantime, I really think, feeling that it was the only way that he could get his own back at the Germans, had joined the Communist Party. And so I moved into this flat with a pro-Western mother, a cultured, educated, charming person, a son who was a medical student and a very bright boy, but a rabid communist. And there was I. And it was, actually, we got on absolutely splendidly, including with the son, Radanek. His mother was Mrs. Berankova.
Berankova.
And he was Radanek. Radanek, and the EK on the end means little, it's a diminutive, you know, an affectionate diminutive. And we got on splendidly, and he used to come into my room and only talk English because he was learning. And he started teaching me Czech, in which there are a number of sounds which simply don't occur in English. And because at that time I was in the way of doing languages here and there, I managed to get most of them, and there was a fairly tricky moment when he was convinced I was a spy and that I really did speak Czech if only I would. But it all smoothed out, and we got on splendidly, and I stayed with him for the rest of my time there and corresponded with his mother for years after that.
Yes, so how long were you there? 49
years.
Yes. That would have, when you were leaving, that would have been the time when things were tightening up very drastically in Czechoslovakia.
Well, I tell you what happened. Mm. They began, the way in which I began to do major public lectures was that the Czech government inaugurated a policy of, at the very last minute, either refusing or withdrawing visas from our VIP visitors. And we would find ourselves with a huge audience and the lecturer not there because he couldn't get into the country. And so all of the fairly senior members of the staff were enlisted, and we were told, you know, go off and take a subject as close to the one that was being given as you can, research it for 2 days and deliver a lecture. And so I found myself stretched about as being British medieval defence establishments and all sorts of interesting subjects. It was fascinating. But all the way, they were making it more and more difficult. They did not want, actually, to throw us out because, at the time, there was an Anglo-Czech friendship society in London, which was confidently believed to be a hotbed of espionage. And if they threw us out, clearly there would be a quid pro quo, and they didn't want their institute thrown out of London. And so they went about it by subtle ways. They, for example, they arrested members of our local staff or their families. The father of a family would be taken into Pankwart's prison, and that would be the last that we heard of them during the whole of our time there. Flats would be gone over and wrecked. I mean, it was real terror. They started to put a guard on the entrance to our premises so that people would be seen coming in. And when that didn't keep people away, the guard carried a camera and took photographs. And when that didn't stop them, they were taking down names and addresses. It was really hotting up. Now, in the council, on the council staff, there was a woman doctor by the name of Anna Ride.
R-E-R-I-D-E.
A-R-N-A. R-I-D-E. And I never met her. She had left just before I arrived in 1949. But the story that I heard was this. She was a middle-aged little woman, a doctor of medicine, plain, not an immediately fascinating or entrancing person. She was the only child of parents who had been middle-aged to older when she was born, and the story went that they'd been getting on very well without her, and that she came as rather a surprise package. And when she came to Czechoslovakia, where the Czechs were embarrassingly pro-British, to their own danger, I mean, they entertained us in their homes, they were incredibly good to us, for the first time in her life, she really felt cherished. And clearly, someone in authority along the way picked up the vibes. And the time came when her parents fell ill and she asked for extended leave to go home and nurse them through their final illness. And so she left just before I arrived. And over the ensuing months, the rep noticed that parcels were coming through in the diplomatic bag addressed to Anna Ride. And being cunning, you know, their brain box began to go into action. And so he wasn't completely taken aback when on a specific Saturday lunchtime, she broadcast an absolutely vitriolic denunciation of the British Council and all its works, naming members of the local staff who had been her mainstay in support. And it really was quite appalling. And that was the sign. She was back in Prague, and the government used her arrival, which obviously they had connived at and planned and provided accommodation and so on for her, to set up the final assault on the council.